Well, good morning, Tim.
Good morning, even though it's afternoon.
We're recording it in the afternoon, as per usual, but you may well be listening to us on Wednesday morning, in which case, hope you had a nice breakfast.
It's going to be a beautiful day, that's for sure, Tom.
It's already very hot, and of course, Wednesday is supposed to be even hotter. And it was supposed to be the day when Liverpool won the Premier League, and they're beginning the biggest bottle job in the history of football. I can already sense it. And I've got to get my head in the right gear to be prepared for the worst happening.
But there's a few games left. You're okay.
There are a few games, and that's fine. We had a wonderful weekend, didn't we? But I'll tell you what, we put an awful lot out. And I will say that it very nearly killed me this weekend. But I will also say that it also filled me with the biggest amount of joy imaginable, hearing responses of people to various things, whether it was last week's podcast, the update on Friday, our bedtime story, which was one of my favourite
stories. That was excellent.
Jonah and the Very Big Fish. I had good fun with the sound effects.
Yes, because being sick, the being sick thing was quite fascinating, the four words they had for being sick. But
it was good.
We got the gist of the story.
Yeah. And then, of course, we had Sunday service, which was excellent, and then we had communion by Zoom. We had no technical difficulties, everything went well. We played There Is a Redeemer, the song, and we'll be sharing that with you as a church in a morning service very, very soon. So we're very much looking forward to that. And then we had our dramatic reading of Daniel chapter 1 and all the stuff that's come out of that. And by the end of it all, we got to Monday, and I think both me and you, Tim, just went,
but it was all great, wasn't it? And it was great on Zoom just to see everybody. It does.
So it
makes me well up, actually, every time I see a mass Zoom of just seeing everybody there.
More people than can fit on the screen.
I know, two screens. Yeah, so and it's lovely. And everyone's looking really good and really well. And just very, very glad and very blessed to be part of Newcastle Baptist Church.
Well, today, of course, is a very special podcast for us. We have been blessed by having some people join us for the past few weeks who've had little bits of input. It was great to have a chat with Rachel in South Africa a few weeks ago. And today we're joined by our good friend and regional minister for our area. He's not quite from South Africa, but we're going to get a chance to speak with Dave today, aren't we, Tim?
Yes. So the Reverend Dave Ellis. Dave, it's lovely to have you here today, and thank you for agreeing to be our guest for this particular podcast. I know that many at NBC will have met you in the past. I've heard many a story about you. I'd hate to think they were all true, but maybe most of them are. And you and your guitar are famous in these parts. Would that be fair, David?
Yes, that would be fair. I was once in hospital, laid up in bed. A woman came over to me, said, "I know you, I know you." And I thought, "Great preacher?" She said, "No." "Great children's talk?" She said, "No." "You're the guitar man."
And there we are.
I'll put that on my headstone.
It's good to be known for something, Dave. And but maybe today you'll become famous for even more than being a guitar man. But it's great to have you. And we've met a couple of times since I've been here as well. And I've really appreciated the conversations we've had and your encouragement and support that you've given to me during this time when I've been settling in at NBC as well. This is a great church, isn't it, Dave? You know that?
Yeah, fantastic church, very talented people. You've done a lot in the community, you've done a lot as a church. Maturity of Christians is quite something phenomenal. It's always a place I like visiting.
Yeah, well, thanks, David. And we look forward to continuing to have contact with you in the future as well. But obviously, we're in this really strange time. I don't know how many weeks we're in now. Is it 14 weeks or 15 weeks or something like that of lockdown? So, Dave, how has lockdown been for you? Because it's meant a lot of changes for us in local church, but I'm sure for you in your role at Heart of England Baptist Association as a regional minister, I'm sure there's been changes. But what about at home? How's life at home during lockdown?
Well, you know, it's been quite strange for all of us, hasn't it? Even though it might be a bit normal now. At first, we used to get our granddaughter half the week by way of care, and then immediately that stopped. as my daughter stopped working. And so we didn't see her for the first 6 weeks. I mentioned that to somebody online, and I heard my wife start to cry in the kitchen because she had realized that she hadn't seen her granddaughter for at least 6 weeks. So it's been very strange. Unfortunately as well, I've had to isolate myself because I'm diabetic.
Okay.
And apparently my skin color makes me susceptible to COVID-19 as well.
Of course.
So practically for 12 weeks, I've been in isolation. Very rarely have I gone out. Job-wise, we stay in contact with a lot of people by phone or by email. So that's quite strange as well. And if I Zoom is my life, all my meetings are held in Zoom. Sometimes that's great, but sometimes you can get zoomed out.
Yeah, well, we're recording this on Zoom, but I hope this isn't a step too far for you. But
you
do look really good on Zoom, Dave, by the way. And if only the people listening could see you, it would enhance our conversation so much more. But we'll just have to imagine what it is that you're looking like today. But now you've been obviously a regional minister now. You're a Baptist minister. You've been doing this for quite a time now. But where did this all start for you? Where did faith start for you? Were you brought up in a Christian family, or how did it all sort of happen for you in terms of coming to follow Jesus?
I think my family used to send us, me and my brother, off to church on a Sunday morning so they could clean the house and get Sunday lunch ready. And fortunately for us, there weren't that many cars on the road then, but before the cheeky ones say, yeah, it was awesome cars. Nobody could afford a car back in my day. We could walk to church quite comfortably. And at the age of 5, we moved to a part of Wolverhampton where we could walk to church. And I remember my first day at Dunster Road Tabernacle. Me and my brother went into church. Tim will remember this. You didn't get long trousers until you were 12 years old. So me and my brother went to church in our short trousers. We were greeted by a chap called George Scrivens, who went, the Sunday school sit in the front. If you join the Boys Brigade, you'll sit on the right. If you join the youth group, you'll sit on the left. If you get married, you'll sit on the left-hand side of church with the married people. And he laid it all out for us. And he said, but I hope you feel very, very well. And that was our first day in church. So that Dunster Road Baptist Church is where it all started. I would stay in that church through Boys Brigade and Sunday school to the age of 18 when I made my commitment. We took all the youth groups, Boys Brigade, Girls Brigade, youth group, on a church youth weekend. I thought I was going to play football all weekend, and we went to Malvern, which is just hills. And so we were forced to listen to what the minister was saying, and he threw out a word that said, you're either for me or you're against me, God speaking. You're either for me or against me. And our Boys Brigade captain had given his testimony clearly. And we thought, if that's what a Christian is like, that's what we want to become. I went to bed, wrestled with God and said, but God, you know, I want to be a bad man. I want to have loads of girlfriends. And I want to live the life. And when I've been thoroughly bad, I'll come to faith in you. And God said to me, I can save you all of that heartache. Come to me now. And so I woke up early in the morning, knocked on my pastor's door at this residential center. I knew he'd be up because he kept on telling us he prayed really early in the morning. He looked really worse for wear when I knocked the door. But we prayed the prayer of faith, and I've never looked back.
Fantastic. What an amazing story. And when you think it was that welcome at that church, although it doesn't feel like a welcome now, but somebody spotted you and somebody was bothered enough to help you and lead you along. And then obviously a sequence of people in your life who actually were stepping stones in that amazing journey that you had as well.
Yeah.
So I guess Wolverhampton in those days was a bit different, as you said, but I see from the website that you're a Wolf Furian. How do you pronounce that? A person from Wolverhampton.
We call Wolfrunians.
Wulfrunians, right.
And the one of the founders of the town was Lady Wulfruna.
Right.
And she lended her name to the town. And the other part of the town is Heath Town, at the ancient bits of Wolverhampton. And they've combined those to make the name Wolverhampton.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And so, I know a little bit about the history of the place. I love it. Anybody else can say anything they like about it, but I love it. I love it as a city.
I can remember, Dave, as I was dating my now wife, she lived in Telford. I lived in Stoke-on-Trent, obviously. And so for us, Wolverhampton was about halfway. So I have some very fond memories of days out in Wolverhampton.
Did you go courting in the West Park?
I'm not going to pretend to remember what the names of the parks were.
he wasn't looking at the names on the parks when he went, don't you worry. He had other things on his mind.
Oh, my only other experience of Wolverhampton is the beautiful Molyneux, to which I've seen Wolverhampton Wanderers lose twice and win once. And both the times they lost were good for me, and the time that they won was good for me. So there we go. Pretty happy.
And who's playing at Molyneux tonight, Tom?
Wolves are playing. Should I know?
Am
I
of course to... you should.
Is it Bournemouth?
It's AFC Bournemouth they're playing.
quite a significant game for Bournemouth.
And I did have tickets to go until it was cancelled, but never mind. Never mind. Another year, I'll get there to see them. But
maybe.
Yeah, probably not next season. You're right. So, David, I read also that your parents came to the UK from Jamaica. So that was quite a journey for them. What sort of period of time was that when they came over?
Well, they actually met in this country. My dad had come over in 1956.
Okay.
With two of his brothers. They would eventually send for another brother. So when I was growing up, I had my dad and three uncles, who lived in Wolverhampton. So I'm very close to all my cousins because at one stage, we all lived in the same house when we were really little. Our uncles had the same authority as our dad, so you didn't mess around in front of them. Didn't mess around in front of your dad. You didn't mess around in front of them. But it's led to us being a very close family, and my cousins feel like my brothers and sisters. My mum came over in 1960 with her mum. They had settled in London, and then my mum and dad met in Wolverhampton, got married, and then had a dazzling young child. Who would grow up to be a Baptist minister.
Oh, I thought you meant the other one.
Well, then they had the other one.
Yeah. So that was fascinating time then. And so what were your experiences of growing up in Wolverhampton then as a kid? I mean, how did, as you look back on those times, how does it sort of feel now looking back?
Well, I went to schools that were very multicultural. And so, you know, all my friends were Asian, white and black. And all the way through our school life from the age of probably about six, when we moved to a particular part of Wolverhampton, to leaving school, it all seemed lovely and fair.
Okay.
Until, you know, you start weighing up some of the things that happened to you, some of the things that your parents were enduring. I do remember living in a posher part of Wolverhampton, going to school in a posh part where I was picked on at the age of five, prodded with sticks. Mm. Very, very strange. Yeah. I kind of suppressed that memory till recently. Mm. We also moved to a part of Wolverhampton where Enoch Powell was the the member of parliament for Wolverhampton.
Wow.
Every day I went to junior school in particular, we'd go past his constitutional headquarters. In 1968, he'd make his Rivers of Blood speech.
Yeah.
And I'd still be walking past there as a seven-year-old going to school.
Yeah.
As you get older, you sort of think, gosh, I wonder if he ever saw me walk past with my mom, and I wonder what he was thinking. And certainly when I left school at the age of 16, I went into the real world. He began to realize that not everything was as straightforward as it was at school. My parents put up with a lot of rubbish in their time. And so by 1981, when there were riots going on all over the country, I was an angry young man then. Fortunately, I got saved at 18. Because the choices were, you join a gang and fight for your rights, or you join the church. And fortunately, I joined the church.
So some interesting and very challenging times for you, and some very key moments in terms of where your life may have headed at those times as well. So I said we were going to talk about this later, but perhaps it's opportune to talk now, really, is in the light of the current situation then, and the protests and Black Lives Matter, George Floyd and everything, how are you sort of processing all of this? Obviously, having lived through several different times in your life as well, when these issues have sort of peaked a little bit and then diminished a bit, what are you feeling about now and this sort of time?
Well, I've got to admit, when George Floyd first came on the news, I thought, oh, another black man's died in police custody. And I almost took it as a matter of fact, these things happen. It wasn't until I saw the pictures, and I think that's why we're all shocked, really. When we see the pictures of one human life being choked to death by another human, that you could see the horror of all of it unfold, especially when he said, I can't breathe. Heartbreaking. So, of course, the protests started springing up all over the place. Birmingham had a protest. And my son went to it. The two Birmingham protests have been very peaceful. My son went to it. I was incredibly proud that he felt able to go.
And how old is he, Dave? How old?
He's 27 now.
Okay, yep. So, yeah.
Really, so, you know, he's a big person. So, you know, he makes his own decisions. But I'm really glad that he went. And the various protests around the country and around the globe has really pressed home that people have had enough. I've been inspired by the young saying, enough is enough, and we're going to be the generation to make a difference. I must admit, I thought to myself, I said that once, that I'd be the generation that would make a difference. But these guys have taken up with a passion, and it's really reignited my passion for racial justice. I wrote down all the things that had happened to me as a kid, and I wrote 16 pages, and I hadn't even reached the time when I'd gone to Bible college at the age of 21. We had a brick thrown through our window by a National Front. We had National Front people live on our road. Wolverhampton had Ku Klux Klan, a chapter of Ku Klux Klan starter. My mom used to walk around with a snooker cue, the butt end of a snooker cue up her sleeve, to go to town, just in case somebody thought they'd try it on. And she was, Tim, she was vicious, mate. She was vicious. Anybody trying it on would be dead. But in the same token, she slept with a machete under our bed, under her bed, when my dad died, just in case somebody thought they'd kick the door off. So in one sense, you don't live your life thinking about it, but when you add it all up, it's quite a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah, and I mean, that's really interesting to hear, and yeah, very emotional as well, I'm sure. But I think because of the nature of the George Floyd incident, that actually it's left me reflecting on, from my perspective, if you like, over my life, as to how my attitudes and some prejudices can easily step in. But it's powerful to hear that it caused you to reflect a little bit about stuff that you've suppressed before, and it's almost given a voice again to some of that, some of the awful things that have happened to so many people in our nation, really. And that's been really moving to hear people speak about it, and again to hear you speak about it as well, in such a powerful way. And And you've been a pastor in a couple of situations as well, which, and I noticed that you've been part of forums that have been brought together to try and deal with racial justice. Is that right as well?
Yeah.
So how did that, so Totterdown was in the what, 1980s, late 80s?
Totterdown was 1992 to 1990.
Okay. And you were involved in the racial justice issues there?
That's all right.
Talk to me a little bit about that and how that sort of happened.
Okay, back in 1984, when Mission England happened, they kicked off the Mission England in Bristol at the Ashton Gate, the Bristol City Football Ground at Ashton Gate. Mm. But when they finished the mission, the churches, the white churches, realised they never talked to the black churches at all.
Right.
They didn't practically invite them to the mission. So they wrote a report called Grasping the Nettle, talking about Bristol's slave history and the way that the churches really had failed in inviting people of colour to a major mission. And out of that, they started up a project called Keyboard, Black and White Churches Together in Partnership. Mm. And that group had the task of looking how to teach about racial justice, racial harmony and unity, racial awareness. And that what they would do was do seminars, they would hold training days, and also, most importantly, when invited by a denomination in Bristol, they would do an audit on the community where the church was, the racial makeup of the congregation, and the racial makeup of the leadership team. So we go in with empirical evidence, invited to go in, by the way. We go in with the empirical evidence and say, your area's like this, your church is like this, your leadership isn't reflected in any shape or form. Mm. And in the 5 years I was the chairperson for Keyboard, we tackled three denominations. And because they invited us, they all did something towards rectifying that problem. Okay. Mm. Just to make sure you didn't think that I did it, I had two brilliant workers who could really teach and encourage and open people's eyes. And by the time I'd finished in Bristol, Bristol City Council were calling Keyboard in to advise on racial justice issues and to sit on tribunals where race was an issue. Mm. So that really did make a difference. We also took the national racial justice teams around when it was our year to host them. We took them around the centre of Bristol. And that's the first time somebody told me properly about Edward Colston.
Right.
Edward Colston spent a lot of money in the city, got a name, a hall named after him, got his statue, got a school named after him. But this person we got to give us a lecture about the history of Bristol said he was one of the major slave traders and slave owners in the city. And you know, after that, I couldn't look at that statue. Mm. And so when they tore it down a few weeks ago, I was shocked.
Mm.
But I wasn't surprised.
Yeah. How fascinating that's come round again. Yeah. And did you actually see some structural changes in those churches as a result of this work going on, do you think? Was there tangible change?
Yes. The other churches, the churches where we did the survey, I think it was the Methodist Church, Church of England, and the URC. They made changes within their churches to begin to reflect more the diverse community that they had. But then we had two great workers, like I said, who could follow that through and help the churches that were struggling in working out how to implement that, to do it not in a tokenistic way, but in a way that gave people of talents the opportunity to serve.
And I guess part of change is facing up to what the situation is now, isn't it? You know, and actually being bold enough to name it, if you like. You know, here's our community, here's our church, here's our leadership, actually that there's a disconnect. What are we going to do to try and bring that to make change in the midst of that? That's interesting. So when you moved to Small Heath, that was a very different community from Totterdown.
I would say just in between Small Heath and Totterdown, Totterdown and Small Heath, I went on a racial justice conference in Atlanta, Georgia. Went to Martin Luther King Jr.'s church, Ebenezer Street Baptist Church. We had a four-day conference. There were six of us from England, four black British, Fred George, Sri Lankan, with the most plummy English accent you've ever heard, though he looked Asian, and the wonderful Anne Wilkinson Hayes, who was one of the keynote speakers. We went on this conference, and at one point, a civil rights leader who'd marched with Martin Luther King got up and said, I've been with Dr. King many years, marching for justice. And quite frankly, I'm sick and tired of looking at your ugly faces. And basically he was saying, I've been on this trail so long and we haven't made a difference. I'm wondering why I bothered. And as soon as he did that, said that, he broke the ice. And we put together a document that for Britain anyway, would mean London Baptist Association would appoint their first racial justice officer in Rosemary, and that London Baptist Association would employ the first black and Asian regional ministers. And nationally, Wally Hudson Roberts was employed as the racial justice coordinator. So from that conference, we could see that something of change was going to happen or happened in Britain as a direct result of that conference.
And have you seen that change continue from that point, or have you been frustrated a bit by the pace of change, or how does it sort of look now from that time to today, say, in terms of the church?
Well, you know, sometimes it looks like we're doing okay, but most of the time it looks like, oh gosh, we're moving incredibly slowly. You know, I don't want to spend all my life being a colour. I think that's what Michael Jackson said. You know, I just want to be known as Dave, who does this, Dave, this is his ministry, so on and so forth. But when there's injustice, we just have to speak out against it. And it doesn't really matter what colour that injustice is. It just turns out at this moment in time, Black Lives Matters is an important thing. So we've seen some changes over the years, but we could see so much more. We got so many more young people who are talented and articulate, people of colour, who sometimes think the Baptist doesn't give them an opportunity to express themselves. So they might go off to more black majority churches where that can happen. But I'm hoping that we're going to be able to make a difference on the on the back of George Floyd's killing. Because it's the young who have really taken this and run with it.
Yeah, it's been great to be able to chat to Tom over the last couple of podcasts, because obviously he's a young man in a very different generation from me. Tom, have you got anything sort of to reflect back on anything that they've said so far?
Well, I think I can certainly understand what you were saying about it feels like we're moving too slowly. I think that's the right comment. And I suppose what we've seen coming out of other countries, I guess specifically America, has been that it hasn't been that things have moved too slowly. It's that things haven't moved at all. Whereas in the UK, now what's funny is mine and my wife's experiences were very different going through school. I went to a school that was represented by multiple different ethnicities. And I guess it was a more multicultural school. So I didn't really see a lot. But whereas my wife was in a majority white school, and she said that she saw things, and I was very surprised. And we'd never talked about this until it came up recently. And it was only when I began to think, like, I guess for me as a young person, I've not grown up. And whether it's right or wrong, people can argue that it's not the right phrase, but I genuinely haven't grown up seeing colour. It's not been something that has been on the forefront of my mind. But I think when you're saying about young people responding to this, I think it's some of it is that for us, this has opened our eyes to the fact that there is injustice going on. And for some of us, we haven't seen it, or we've maybe been blind to it as we've grown up. However, what's happened is because there's an injustice there, and we don't want to see that. We want to grow up in a world where there is no injustice as a result of the colour of somebody's skin. I mean, when you say it like this, it's just barbaric, isn't it? It's mad that we judge people in that way. So we've grown up almost with this thing saying, okay, we're not talking about it a lot, but actually we're not talking about it a huge amount because some of us aren't seeing it, or maybe we think it's dealt with when actually it isn't. I suppose when it's come up, when it's been at the forefront of things now, to us, it makes us want to say, okay, we want to do something about this because this isn't right. And we feel we can. And I totally understand what you're saying about generations have come before who've said the exact same thing. And to me, that worries me. I get worried when I hear that because that's not what I want to hear. I don't want to hear that this might just be a flash in the pan. And I don't want to be part of a generation that grows older saying, oh, I dealt with it when I was 20, but actually now I'm 45, 50. It doesn't matter to me. Because I don't want to get to that point and it's even something that's considered to be a problem. So I think I totally resonate with what you're saying, that there have been small changes, but clearly we can move far faster and we can do far more to make it just to eradicate it from society.
Okay. Yeah. You know, Dr. King walked with a lot of black ministers, and but the thing about his demonstrations is that he worked with people of all color. And, you know, you see that very much to the forefront of the campaigns. And so one of the things I'm involved in now, just recently springing up, is a thing called Ministers of Color, which is being pushed by our Baptist president, Yinka. And he's just got many of us together to say, A, do we want to make some kind of protest to Parliament, to Boris Johnson, about the situation. We don't want to be in a position as older black church leaders where the younger generation turn around and say, what did you do? When we were busy putting our lives on the line with the possible COVID-19, where were you lot? Keeping yourself safe at home and not answering the problem that is out there in front of us. Okay, the young will ask that question because they're not so threatened by COVID-19, perhaps.
Yeah.
But we felt in our core that we have to respond in some way. So one of the things that Yinka wants to do is call the ministers together, possibly go down to London, either stand on Parliament Square or Trafalgar Square, make a protest to the government, possibly hand in a petition, how that's kind of done, we're trying to work that out, and say the ministers of colour want to stand alongside the youth of this nation and say, enough is enough. A, the killings have to stop. B, there are 200 legislations that have come about for every injust act that's happened in this country. There are 200 legislations that have been brought about over the years. None of them have been fulfilled. And we want to look at the imbalance of black youngsters in the judicial system, being punished by the judicial system. So we're going to stand on those three things and try and make our voice heard. But we're more than willing to take everybody and anybody who's willing to stand alongside us in that. When we have more details, we will let people know. It's up to them if they want to stand beside us. Heber-wise, I wrote my devotion, or did my devotion recently, and I spoke about how I was challenged by Kate Coleman's piece called Are You Mad? And I read it, and I was inspired. And the mad bit is, are you making a difference? And Adrian's been pushing me for the last couple of years to start up a justice hub, because they've wanted that for a little while. A justice hub that will look at racial justice, women's justice, and disability justice. But the truth is, Tim and Tom, you do get tired of making the same noise and wondering if anybody's listening. Thanks to the momentum of the youth, I've been fired up again.
Yeah.
We're gonna call it making a difference Justice Hub. So people have been calling me up and saying, Dave, we want to join your mad group. So we're just looking to begin to put that together. And it's going to be more than a talking shop. Mm. It's going to be things that educate us, teach us, enlighten us. Because, Tom, sometimes it isn't that people are racist. It's sometimes they're just ignorant. They've never had to deal with the issues before. Yeah.
And I think that's my experience, Dave. I think the more I look into it, the more I realise that I probably have been ignorant of what's gone on. And I guess I need to make sure, and we've said from the outset that for anyone who's been listening to our podcasts and who've been joining us for church, that you could argue that if you're really ignorant, then maybe there's a problem. But actually, ignorance isn't something that we need to beat ourselves up over, because actually it's only a problem if we don't do something about it when it's been revealed to us. You can be ignorant of so many things that go on in the world, but that's because you haven't known anything. But it's only when things become revealed to you, as has happened through what has gone on in America. And I think that's what this is. A huge amount of this is an outpouring from people who've actually, as you said earlier, Dave, from the experiences of your mother, who kind of kept things hidden, people have stored things up for so long that actually what's happened is it's just reached this peak. And this peak has just tipped people over the edge. And it is now something that we can't stay silent about anymore. And I think young people, that's where we're at. We kind of are at this point of saying we are not willing to stand for this anymore. And in a way, it's now looking at, okay, what can we do about it? And I guess COVID has made it a bit more difficult, because you kind of feel like people can have a go at you if you go and protest and you do all these things. But the thing I turn around and say is that actually, if people have felt it necessary to go and protest about something in the middle of a pandemic, I don't think that makes them stupid or naive. I think it means that they have seen something that needs to be done. And they felt so passionate about it that they've been willing to put their own life at risk to say, this needs to stop now.
And that's such a powerful statement there, Tom. And I think, if anything, COVID-19 means that we're not rushing around so that bit of news washed over us. Mm. We've got actually time to stop and think and reflect on what we've just seen. If we were living our normal, busy lives, it would have been another black man dead. But now we've seen it, we can't unsee it.
Yeah.
And we have to do something about it. Silence is not an option.
Yeah. I think that's been some of the flip in my head, really. It's not just it's not an issue. It's about being anti-racist, isn't it? You know, it's about there's something proactive. There's something I've got to do about it, rather than just sitting back and thinking I'm okay. You know, I've got it all sorted. It's about what is it we can do to actually confront this evil of racism. And so, Dave, just as we sort of come to land perhaps on our conversation, which has been incredibly powerful and enlightening, thank you so much for your honesty and openness and sharing with us today. What is it the church can do now? What do you think Newcastle Baptist Church, for example, you know, could do now? What are the things that we as individuals and as a church should be thinking about as we try and continue this journey of understanding and also action as well?
Well, there's a lot of good things written on the internet. There's a lot of bad things written on the internet. We can just educate ourselves more. Yeah. We can just try and learn to walk a mile in another person's moccasins. I think you may have said to me, Tim, were you ever in Leicestershire?
No.
I was talking to somebody who'd been in Leicestershire, and I remember they did this experiment where they made a black person white and made a white person black. And they put them through the same experience. In one sense, the black guy didn't learn anything, but the white guy's eyes were so opened. We spoke about going to a football match earlier. As a white guy, he went in a football match and thought nothing about it. might have even joined in the chants against people of colour on the pitch. But as a black guy, he went and he felt so threatened, and he'd never taken it on board how threatening being in that situation really was. I think if we take the time to listen to one another a bit more, learn a bit more from one another, take the opportunities that will come up about racial awareness training, diversity training, inclusion training, because all these things will roll out from Heber and from the Baptist Union now. If we take the chance to learn those things, then we'll understand one another better.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, David. That's been amazing. Thank you for sharing your journey, your experiences, and we're praying for you and the team as well, and obviously the new grouping that you're becoming part of as well, and for our new president as he takes on this issue as well. And we're standing with you in this and praying for you. And hopefully you'll come out of lockdown as well soon, will you? Are you allowed out now?
Well, I've been out now.
Oh, good. Good.
It's quite strange.
It is strange, yeah. but the primary thing is keep safe. Keep safe. The
primary thing and, is still.
Our regards to your wife and to your family as well. And how old is your granddaughter?
She's 3 years old.
Oh, beautiful.
In the height of lockdown, she was wondering why every time she went up to a person, they were walking in the opposite direction.
Yeah, it's a strange thing.
They don't understand.
But plenty of cuddles still to come, I'm sure. And she'll look forward to all of that as well.
Thank you, Tim. Love to the church. Look
thank
forward
you.
To seeing you in the flesh.
Let me just pray for you as we sort of finish this and say goodbye. Father, we just want to thank you for your love for us. I just want to pray a blessing on Dave as he continues his walk of faith with you. Thank you for your call upon his life. Thank you for his determination to grab hold of that call and to express that in leading churches and now at the regional team as well. And I pray that as he takes these new steps, Father, that you'll continue to go ahead of him and open amazing doors of opportunity for him. And that he'll grab hold of this time in a way that will continue to declare your kingdom for all people at this time and for the future. Pray blessing on him as well as a husband, as a dad, as a granddad. I pray that you'll use him to share your love with his family and to those that he works with as well. So, Father, we just ask for your continuing wisdom as we continue this journey, and that you'll go ahead of us and surround us, and we'll be just obedient to the whisper of your spirit. I pray that in the name of Jesus. Amen.
Amen.
Thanks, David. God bless you.
Brilliant. Tim,
catch up again soon.
Say, another encouragement to the people. It's just, so many things you could say. Just remind the people that Baptists were at the forefront of the anti-slave trade.
Mm-hmm.
Whether they fought in Jamaica or fought in this country, they were the forefront there. When you go to Jamaica, the Baptist Church is seen as the ones who stood with the slaves against slavery. And also Martin Luther King. So the Baptists, again, are at the forefront of civil rights movement. And there's no reason why in the 21st century the Baptists should still be at the forefront of fighting racism. Okay, so if you somehow work that into your introduction, that'd be great.
We don't need to say any more, David. Thank you. I look forward to you coming here and sharing that with us as well. So thank you.
Bless you, man. Bless you.
I think I can leave that recording in exactly as it just
absolutely.
Went. I think it can.
Oh, really? You're still recording?
I've left the recording on.
Hey.
We'll say goodbye to the listeners. Thanks for joining us today. I should have been recording Dave as he flops back on his sofa giggling there. What a sight. Anyway, thanks for joining us for our podcast today. Have a wonderful week. We'll see you on Sunday at 10:30 for worship with us. And then, of course, all the rest of the stuff that's going on through the week. Have an amazing time until then. Bye.
Bye.
Send me the link. Bye.